present. Okay, great. So thanks for staying until the end. This is getting probably pretty long day. And I'd like to thank the organizer for giving me a chance to speak at KITP. It's always a pleasure to be back. So I'm going to talk about higher-spin Gitaev model. I noticed that we had a lot of Gitaev discussions yesterday and had none until now. So I'm going to bring back the Gitaev. Basically, this work has been mainly done by my student, Peter, especially this higher-spin Gitaev model. And so I'm going to start with the same thing. Like, we are interested in quantum spin liquid, which has a long-range entanglement with a fractional excitations, and those fractional excitations can be bosons or Majorana's and so on. And things that we are knowing is that it's a spin half. I just want to emphasize that the exactly solvable model is confined to the spin half Gitaev spin liquid and spin half toric code models. And there are other exactly solvable examples, but they are not really, really, in a sense that not very realistic so far. If you go to, I don't have to discuss this because I'm pretty sure you have seen it several times yesterday, that the Gitaev spin liquid is basically coming with the bond-dependent interactions, exactly solvable G2 spin liquid with a linearly dispersing Majoranas. So that brings into this person here. And well, so I'm going to talk about basically higher spin Gitaev, but to talk about the higher spin Gitaev, I noticed that I like to bring some review on spin half bond-dependent interactions in real materials, how they come and why they are sensitive to certain distortions, and how one can determine the strengths of those spin exchange interactions. And then I'll talk about how you do, you know, microscopic derivations of the Gitaev interaction for spin one. And then I'll talk about, this is basically, we haven't, this is very recent work, which has been done by Kiran, and that has been just basically about a week old, the data that we have. So I'm going to briefly talk about the spin one case, what is the field-induced spin liquid state that we are seeing in the numerical data. Okay, so this is, again, just to remind you that the when you're talking about the spin half, it's effectively total spin half, and there are several conditions which is kind of behind the scene of this beautiful, simple interaction. But to get into that much beauty, you have to go through the dirty jobs. And those complex dirty jobs are basically all this requirement. So you're starting from some cubic crystal field, where this crystal field is larger than any other interactions or comparable to the Hubbard interactions. And then one has to add a spin-orbit coupling to break this into J effective half and then J effective 3/2, where effectively it's coming from the fact that we have to remove the easy orbitals. So this is a theory word. In reality, of course, we do have finite, finite gap here, finite crystal field, which is about like a 2 eV. So it's not like infinity, but one can, let's say, ignore it. Then at that point, one uses spin-orbit coupling and Hund's coupling. So we do need crystal field, we need a spin-orbit coupling, we do need a Hund's coupling. Once you have all of those, then and then at the same time, we have to have a D5. So this constraint put it into the limited candidate material. So when you have D5, then we'll have, okay, it's a half field, J effective half band, and now we need a honeycomb lattice. So on top of crystal field, spin-orbit coupling, Hund's coupling with the D5, and then we need a honeycomb lattice to get the candidate material for the Gitaev. So, well, if you have a just a straightforward scale lattice, then this, in fact, was used to explain the multi-insulator in the strontium 214, which is isostructure to the high TC cuprate, and that's where this was studied. Like, they want to see a high TC in non-cuprate material, but still, we haven't found the superconductor in this, you know, even you dope it. But in any case, so all of these conditions has to be implemented to start the thinking about the what type of spin exchange that we can get. So if you put it in a honeycomb lattice, I mean, this Guignet and Joes has done lovely work in 2009 showing that if you go through only these anions, which is through the oxygens in this case, because candidate material has oxide. So you go through the oxide, which is like 90 degree, then if you had only this indirect exchange process, then we end up with this cation interactions, which will be proportional to Hund's coupling. And TO here is the indirect hopping going through these oxygens, okay? And this one here, J, is going to be then direct hopping, or you have to go much higher orders to get the Heisenberg interactions. And then they sort of suppose, you know, kind of propose that the this honeycomb iridate, because iridate coming with 5D with atomic number 77, it's known that atomic spin-orbit coupling is about 400 to 500 millielectron volt. It's big enough that this cation interaction can be generalized or realized in this particular compound. And then we have started looking at this and then just go through a little bit of calculation and start to recognize that, well, actually, it's not just Kitaev and Heisenberg. You end up with so-called gamma interactions. If you have an ideal honeycomb, so this is a 2D ideal honeycomb, and so we don't even have any distortion at this stage. You have ideally perfect cubic lattice, cubic symmetry in this octahedra, and then you put it in an ideal case, then these are the three interactions that are allowed by not only symmetry. One can also derive these interactions and see what happens. So how you can get the bond-dependent interaction is related to the wave function of the J-effective electron. So total J-effective is made of the different T2G orbitals, and then it's a different spin. So it's important that when you say that J-effective half with a press half, which is a press in the JZ basis, it's not the spin is up, it's actually the pseudo spin is pressed, while we have the spin, real spin is for the XZ and YZ orbitals are going to be down, and then XY is going to be up. So we have angular momentum, which is giving you press one here, and then spin is minus half, so that generates into the pseudo spin half. And then when you put it in the time reversal, then this will act just like a spin half. So I remember some of students were asking, like, well, you are dealing with a total spin. How do you know that this is act like a spin when you put the magnetic field? But in fact, that this will act just like a spin half, so you don't have to worry about now all the other aspect. But what's important is that this pseudo spin is made up of the different orbitals with the different spins. So once you have that, the effective half of this orbital wave functions, the total wave functions, then you can see, for example, how you get the gamma interactions, because the way the gamma interactions are coming in is that it has the, if you remember, let's go back to the this one here. So when you look at the Z bond here, which is this red one, the Kitaev interaction will take SZ, Ising-like, and then gamma interaction along that bond will take SX, SY, plus SY, SX. So this sign is not a minus. If you have minus, it's nothing but a Zalozinski-Moria. But if you have a plus here, you can rewrite them in terms of S plus, minus, S minus, S minus. So in other words, we have to flip the two spin at the same time going through this process. So we call that at that time is off-diagonal symmetric exchange, which was probably too long. But in any case, so that's the one. And then you can use the C3 symmetry to get the other bond. So here will be our XX in this Kitaev, and then this part here, gamma interaction will take SY, SZ, and then SZ, SY, and so on. So that's the form of the interaction. So let's think about this G bond here, and how you get the gamma interaction is that going through, for example, this is a site one, site two. So we just have to work on the two site, which is one in here, site one and site two. And what we have to do is a perturbation theory. So you start with a single particle problems where I have working on a hole basis, by the way, because it's a D5. Instead of having five electron fielding up all of this, it's easier to think in as a one hole. So this red colors you can consider as a one hole. And if you have one hole in the XZ orbitals, let's say down, but remember that down real electron is going to represent in the JZ basis is a press, as I have shown you in the total wave function. So in terms of total wave function, this is going to be press half. And then on the other hand, if I have a hole in the XY orbitals, this will be plus again, because it's xy is up is a plus, while the xzyz is a down is actually a plus. So now let's hop to the one state here, which will be a process of T2, that I'm going to take this xz holes and then moving into this state. So this will be my site 1, site 2. Since I moved one of those down electron to another now in the yz, which is going through either direct hopping between two or can go through these options in the middle, and I end up with up and down holes in this T2z basis. So that's a site 1, which is D6. You can take this as completely filled, so nothing happens here, no actions. This is like a D4, because I have four electrons or two holes, depending on whether they align together or not, you will have this Hund's coupling coming in. But note that what's really interesting here is that two particles in state are not this simple one of those, but it comes as a singlet of either up-down in this orbital or down-up in these other orbitals. And there are other processes that I have ignored. I just want to show you one example where intermediate state, which is a two-particle state, are coming as a singlets of these configurations. So if I'm taking one of those states now, I use the T3, which is an XY to XY, I'm going to take one of those XY into, for example, back to the site 1 again. Then I end up with XY now downspin here, and then YZ to be an upspin. So in the JZ basis again, when XY is a down, I end up with the JZ being a minus half, and then when XYZ is up, this is JZ, you know, JZ total wave functions is actually a minus half. So going through this process, which is a T2, it's indirect hopping through now direct hoppings. This product will give me basically connecting the up, up, and down, down JZ state. So when I'm writing in terms of JZ, J space, this is going to give me one of those terms, S1, S2, plus, plus, or minus, minus. So that's how you end up with the gamma interactions.
Why do we have U minus JHC?
Yeah, this is because...
In the singlet state, actually, minus JHC, if you have triplet. But if you have
because I'm using the holes here. So when you take it into account electrons, you have up, 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 and then down here. So I end up with up, 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 and down. So that's where you got the minus. And this is only one of them. You have another one. So, yes, right, exactly. So this is a real thing now. So just want to show you this slide to tell you that when we are talking about how big the GitHub, how big the gamma, and how big and sine of Heisenberg, it varies depending on the theoretical calculation. And the reason for that is simply because you go through even this, I didn't even include the EZ process. I'm going to the T2Z and then going to the options and then T2Z coming back. And in this simplest nearest neighbor JK gamma interactions, if you include the indirect as well as direct hopping process, we end up with this perturbation theory will give us these forms here. So now T1 is between the XG, XG or YZ, YZ. T2 is the one that contains this indirect hopping through the auctions as well as direct hopping. And then T3 is the sigma bond, sigma hopping here, which will go into the DD sigma type of thing. And so if you have only a TO here, which is indirect hopping, you can see that T1 and T3 are zero. So if you take a T1, T3, zero, this is gone, and gamma is gone. We end up with minus T2 square, and that's where the Kitaev interaction becomes ferromagnetic. So when people say if Kitaev interaction is ferromagnetic, dominantly ferromagnetic, it's because this PD orbital overlap actually dominate and there's no direct hopping. So if you take the limit that the direct hopping is not there, we only have a negative, well, ferromagnetic Kitaev interaction. On the other hand, in reality, of course, we don't have just the indirect. Despite that they are small, these interactions are there. And this interaction, this hopping is not small at all. It's a sigma type of the hopping, and they come with a different sign from a pi. So this is a pi, and this one is mainly a pi hopping, and this is a DD sigma hopping, which are different sign. So you can see that, for example, why the Heisenberg interaction is small, and that's because they come with this one is a complete positive. This is absolute positive and positive. On the other hand, if you look at this one here, this comes with a T1 times T2 twice of T3, 12 T1, T3. But T1 is positive while T3 is negative. So this composition here, which will give you a negative contribution to the J, well, these are positive, positive. So they cancel. So that canceling process gives Heisenberg to be small in actual materials. And depending on the, whether you are dealing with lithium iridium oxide or sodium iridium oxide or alpha ruthenium chloride 3, the numbers will change. And then also the Hubbard interaction and Hund's coupling will have different numbers. And depending on that, that can be rather small or big. And if you look at the guttaev interaction, they also have a two contribution, indirect hopping here, which is basically contain mainly of this TO process, comes with a minus 3 here. So this will give you a ferromagnetic, but on the other hand, if you have a direct hopping dominant, then T1 minus T3, they actually add up because T1 and T3 comes different sign, and you scare them. So this is actually a pretty large term, and you subtract the positive minus the something, which is again a positive, so they can be small or depending on the sign. So depending on the material, one has to look at the details of this hopping process. Even you put it into the, some simple perturbation theory, we end up with some different signs and the strengths can change and so on. Gamma interaction is similarly, you have T1 minus T3, so that can add up, in fact, because they come with a different sign again, and this will be positive, and then T2 is positive. So gamma is generally a positive, but they can be big or because there's no cancellation process. And you can also see that these two terms, which is a bond-dependent interactions, in fact, comes with this Hund's coupling. So without the Hund's coupling, none of them exist. So that's the one thing. And when the this options and the d orbital overlap dominate, then strength-wise, one can show that guttaev and gamma are generally bigger than the Heisenberg interactions. So I want to just to show you this because when you are dealing with the constructing the higher spins, we don't have this process. It's you need some new idea to get the bond-dependent interactions. So this is how you can get it. Now, if you look at the ordered phase near the guttaev spin liquid, so this is a JK, the guttaev and Heisenberg circle that was found by Guignard and Jose. And we're basically filling out the circle by adding a gamma interactions here. So if you add the gamma, which is a seta going from pi by 2 here, which is gamma is 0 line, and then moving along the center, this will be a 0. So this center will be a gamma-only model. You can see the gamma-only model seems like having a little difficulty. This is a 24-site cluster ED calculation with only a positive gamma. You can do a negative gamma, in a, so antiferromagnetic gamma. And what you notice that the guttaev, you know, this antiferro guttaev is tiny. Similarly, ferromagnetic guttaev is actually very tiny phase space. At least it's not a point. So it has contained some stable phase space. And another thing is that while this is extremely narrow range of the guttaev spin ligand, in fact, we are in a sense lucky that the this material that have been studied, like a ruthenium chloride 3 and then sodium and lithium iridium oxide, with this nearest neighbor interactions with the J3, in fact, the most of these materials are in, sitting nearby here. So comes with a positive gamma based on the ab initio and then neutrons and so on, fitting to the experimental data. The spin interactions are most likely antiferro gammas and then ferromagnetic guttaev, and sitting somewhere here where the Heisenberg is very, very small. And then there are other phases which are almost ordered. So I want to emphasize that this is because it's very close by the ferromagnetic guttaev, it is possible to get this ferromagnet guttaev spin liquid, maybe by the field or other way, like by means of the strain or something else. Given that the actual material is not ideal honeycomb, you have some trigonal distortion, and this trigonal distortion is going to generate another term, which we call the gamma prime. And if you have a compressive, because ruthenium chloride is the structure has some histories. This one coming with the old structure, which is a P312. It's a basically orthorhombic structures. And then later on, Radu made some contribution that he said that it's actually a C2M, it's a monoclinic. And there's other crystal which say now rhombohedral, it's a R3 bar. So depending on the structures, any whatever we have, in fact, that if you have a R3 bar, which is a trigonal distortion, if it is a compressive, this gamma prime term will become ferromagnetic. If it's elongated, it's going to be an antiferromagnetic. So this gamma term is also, gamma prime term comes in, and nearby this area here, which I just zoom in, and what you can show is that if it is a compressive, where the gamma prime to be negative, then in fact that area which have a hard time to distinguish what type of magnetic order we have within this finite size ED, that in fact that this will stabilize a zigzag order. So there is a zigzag order that can be also stabilized by this trigonal distortion or further neighbor interaction that Rose Valenti has also proposed, which can also work to stabilize the zigzag orders in actual materials. Now, so apart from this iridium oxide, the guttaev material, another thing that you want to bear in mind is that the ruthenium chloride was proposed to be a guttaev material, and ruthenium is actually a 4D, so, and it's atomic number 44. If you look at the atomic spin-orbit coupling, it's only about 120 to 150 millielectron volt, about three times smaller compared to the iridate. However, we notice that this one has a very narrow bandwidth. So when you compare the energy scale, of course, we compare with the bandwidth, and bandwidth was also small compared to the iridiums. So we thought that, well, this might be a good candidate for the guttaev material. And additionally, in addition to that, ruthenium is a 4D. So when you move into the 3D, 4D, 5D, the Hubbard interaction is actually smaller. So 5D case, Hubbard interaction is small, but 4D in case, it's even bigger. So it's better than the iridium in terms of the electronic correlation. So in the end, the electronic correlation, what we have noticed is that J effective half and 3 half are better separated. So this works for the, by the way, D5. So in the D5 case, we note that these are also better separated. So the Hubbard interaction increases effective spin-orbit coupling, and we thought that this will eventually go into the zigzag order. But we were using a different crystal structure from the monoclinic. So at this time, there was no crystal structure. This is 2015. There was no actual crystal structure analysis. So the one that we used was the P312, which was old crystal structure back in 1980s. And if you use that crystal structure, in fact, the guttaev is positive. So guttaev comes as a positive, and then we have Heisenberg interaction, which was slightly negative, and that's why we end up with a zigzag. So rather than being a guttaev interaction to be ferromagnetic, this calculation, in fact, we found that with the old crystal structure, it was anti-ferromagnetic guttaev. So one has to be very careful when we say, like, okay, this has to be ferroguttaev or anti-ferroguttaev. That is not absolutely true. It can go either way, and when you're applying for a material, okay, then one has to be careful about what crystal structure do we have, because these things are sensitive to the chlorine positions. Chlorines can move around, and depending on the chlorine positions, which will give you a different angle to a transition metals, you can have a very different Hopping parameters that will change the sum of your strengths. Of course, there has been a many you know, exciting progress along these lines, but you know, smoking gun signature is a half quantized thermal hole conductivity, and we had a very nice talk by Yuji Machida-san yesterday talking about this half quantized thermal hole. I mean, this is absolutely exciting and amazing discovery, but I think that is to be continued. We'll see how this evolves and different angles and so on. We'll have to wait to hear more about that. Okay, so that was just the preparation for the spin half, and I think I have only 5 minutes, which is wonderful. Okay, so I want to talk about the larger spins. So for spin, arbitrarily spin, because actually Bhaskaran has a very nice paper, and he has shown that even you have a guttaev interactions with the arbitrarily spins, you can still have this Plaquet operator that will commit with the Hamiltonian, and that itself commits with each other. So classical spin, classical guttaev is exactly solvable. You have exponentially many ground state, and if you put it in a quantum, it's not exactly solvable, but you still have this Plaquet operator, which means that the spin-spin correlation will be ultra short. You have only finite spin-spin correlation in the nearest neighbor, and everything else is going to be zero. So since it's not exactly solvable, but he has giving us some intuition that you might still have this G2 gauge structure. Despite that, we don't know if it has a quantum spin leakage. We further do not know what type of fractional excitations we have, the statistics of it. It might be a Majorana, it might be a bosonic excitations. Well, it might have a difference between half integer and versus the integer spins. And I go back to some of the literature studies. It was done by Nazu as well as the Rajiv Singh, and they have done some calculations using this high temperature expansion or this quantum thermal, the pure thermal state calculation. And they show that you have half plateau. It's a log 3. This is a spin 1, so it's when it's saturated, it'll be entropy will be log 3. And in the middle, there'll be half of entropy again appears in the case of the spinner. So now how we get the spin 1 in Kitaev interactions, that's the question. So remember that you need some kind of mixtures of the spin and the bond to get the bond-dependent interaction. But when you're talking about the spin 1, we are talking about D2 or D8. So in this case, we have a strong Hund's coupling. Once you have a strong Hund's coupling, then we don't have these mixtures. They will be all aligned either up, and that's it. So this is where we start thinking about it. Maybe we can get with using something else, different mechanisms. So we have a D8. This is a nickel, for example. We'll have a D8 nickel duprise, for example. Then you put it in a Hund's coupling. Here I'm using the crystal field splitting is bigger than the Hund's coupling. So this is far away. T2G is completely filled. We are talking about two electrons in the EG. It's a spin 1 state. And spin-orbit coupling in this 3D material is smaller than the Hund's coupling. So there's no mixtures of different spins and different orbitals, but how we can get the bond-dependent interaction. So here we are using heavy anions. If you use heavy anions like iodide, for example, it's just going to the very below the periodic table, p orbitals will split into half and 3/2, and there's this p orbital spin-orbit coupling. If you have ionized, its atomic spin-orbit coupling is almost 800. It's actually pretty big. So that's something to bear in mind. Now the process is very straightforward. It's a standard process that we do. We put it on-site Kanamori interaction in both metal as well as anions. So we put it both of them, and then we work in the fully occupied p orbitals, and then dealing with the spin of 1. So then it's better to, again, working on the whole space because it's a fully occupied. When you're moving around, we better to work on the whole space. Now we have to deal with the two site, and then the two site will have three different type of the T1, T2, T3, but if you put it in a cubic symmetry, they are not independent. They are set by this symmetry, so they have some strengths which are fixed, and once you use that, and then go through, these are the p orbitals of, let's say, heavy anions. These are EG orbitals of either x square minus y square or the g squares. You go through that process. Perturbation theory involves all the intermediate states, so this calculation is not actually trivial like getting a Heisenberg. You go through all of them very carefully and then put them together, keep up to the fourth order. This is single hole process, has ring type or exchange type. Two hole process, go through this, where the Hund's coupling also coming to play. You put them all together, and then that's the conclusion. So we got end up with, it's an indirect case, going through the anions. Kitaev interaction is always twice bigger compared to the indirect super exchange, the Heisenberg term, and it comes with a different sign. And this is the form if you take some particular limit. Otherwise, it's very complicated. So if you take the particular form, it's like that. And if I take a Mott limit where the U is smaller than the crystal field, delta is the difference between the atomic difference between the transition metal and anions. And you end up with some simple form, something like T effective square divided by U, where T effective is proportional to the spin-orbit coupling in the lambda. So that's indirect one. Direct one is always giving you this well-known textbook Heisenberg terms. If you put gamma term is always zero up to the fourth order, it's exactly zero. You have to go higher order to get the finite gamma. And that's the Hamiltonian. So we end up with antiferromagnetic Kitaev. And then Heisenberg can change depending on which one is bigger. Indirect one is always ferro, while the direct is antiferro. So this is, in fact, antiferro. And then if you look at the 12 site, 18 site, ED calculation, we end up with some kind of spin leakage, and negative one is zigzag, and then this is antiferromagnet, so we do end up with some finite spin leakage. Candidate material, this is something really fun, because I was looking for something of the spin one, and I had hard time to find any of much, except the triangular lattice, you know, the transition metal diazirconides. So here is the oxide, comes with the X, which is a bismuth or antimony. So sphenomic coupling of anions should come from around the fact that these guys are influencing these other oxidants around it. So the ab initio calculation is very hard to do this because bismuths and antimonies are basically covalent. So the calculation is difficult to get any tight binding parameters. But what I noticed from the experiment is that these are the two experiments from this paper. In fact, it's rather not that recent. But in any case, what they have seen is that their entropy only saturates up to the only a half. This is twice is because they are counting both two nickels. So this is coming from nickel and the nickels and have only a halfway. And this is a nil temperature. They are ordering zigzag, by the way. And another candidate will be this guy's here, nickel iodine two with the spin one triangles. I thought that was interesting, but the triangle lattice Kitaev is not that giving you fancy phase diagrams, but it has something interesting. This one is the 3½. We are still working on it because it's a 3½, so requires much more. You know, someone was asking, like, okay, what is the microscopic interactions? All this van der Waals materials. Well, it's difficult. We tried this one. We got something on this. Well, we tried this one is extremely hard, so we are still have to do some more work. So now I'm almost done. So just want to talk to you this field-driven U1 spin liquid in a spin half. Well, do we get this in a spin one? Yes, we do. So this is the field along the 12 site, along the 111. This is the 18 site that Kiran has done. This is what Peter has worked on. You see that independent of geometry or directional magnetic field, we always end up with the collapse of this a lot of the state. And this might telling us that there is something going on even in the spin one system. So it will be nice to check it out. And these are just showing you that dynamic structure factor specific heat. We don't find any difference between the spin on and spin off, indicative that it might be a G2 spin liquid with some excitations. Okay, we still don't know. We have to deal more about, you know, here's an open question that, okay, so I don't know what the fractional, the statistics of fractional excitation, low field and intermediate field, but it's something that, you know, I think it's very exciting to work on. So with that, thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you very much. First question.
For the thermal Hall effect, do you expect anything different from a spin one system than a spin half system?
Yeah, so that depends on the what will be excitations here. Like if we got a Majorana excitations, then I would think it's the same. But on the other hand, if these are like bosonic excitations, we don't get the same as the half at all. Because it's the fact it's a half quantized is coming from the fact that it's a Majorana excitations, which is half of complex fermions. So that depends on whether the statistics of this fractional particles that we end up with the spin one case.
Two comments, actually. One of them is to this material, this nickel, is honeycomb lattice. There is such material also which is rather well studied. Maybe it's not heavy enough. This nickel phosphorus sulfur 3, nickel PS3. Mm. And it can be also made with selenium. That's actually Jaegyeon Park in Seoul studied a lot. And that's actually with nickel, it exists with nickel, with cobalt, with iron. It's simply antifermacet. Mm. Okay, and the second comment actually, going back to S1½, I didn't really follow in details actually S1 story, but S1½, you did really great and very careful job to collect all the different terms.
Yes.
But I only want to comment that it's a rather dangerous game because I can present you at least two more terms which can also contribute. For example, one of them is exchange from occupied E to G to empty real EG via 10dQ.
Yes, yes.
That's actually 10dQ, of course, is in denominator is large, but TPD sigma squared is much larger than TPD pi, which you include. That may be also competing.
Right.
Then another term for charge transfer insulator, there's not only hopping from one iridium to another iridium and back, which cancel actually due to this 90-degree bonds, but there may be also process of moving two electrons from one oxygen to the right and oxygen to the left and back. Mm-hmm. That's actually having not U but charge transfer energy delta in denominator.
Mm-hmm.
But in this one's terms, there is no cancellation at all, even for the terms which usually people consider.
Mm-hmm.
So in principle, it's rather a dangerous game, what I want to say.
Yes, yes, I agree. Because so what Daniel has been telling us that the one that I have, as I said, actually, during the talk, that I have included only this T2Z, or this one here, T2Z going through the oxygen p orbitals and coming back. But in fact, we have this empty space here. Yeah. So easy is the something that can go through and come back. And in fact, the DD pi process is what he's saying correctly, that this process is, can be bigger than the this DD pi signals. And if you include that, then these numbers can also change. So yes. But on the other hand, what I was trying to say is that yes, you have, even you're dealing with the even simplest T2Z without even dealing with the, you know, EG, you end up with many tons that coming with the different signs and so on, so one has to be careful. Yes.
What I want to say is that there are a few more terms which
yes.
are not included.
Yes, but we can
easily compete with the ones you include.
Yes, yes. So in principle, I could add it, and then they can change the numbers and signs and so on. And then they can also change the, depending on the structure of the lattice as well. So yes, it is delicate. One has to be careful. Yeah.
When you say Kanamori interaction, you mean also spin flip and pair hopping
yes.
terms,
yes.
not only density
yes.
density.
Yeah. Okay. Yes, correct. So you end up with UU prime J and then yes. pair hopping all of them.
So very interesting. I've got a very naive question. So the examples that you gave, you have a relatively light transition metal ion like nickel in proximity to something heavier as a mechanism for generating the Kitaev mm-hmm. type interactions. And so would that same strategy work in the more established Kitaev systems? Like, would ruthenium triiodide or tribromide be better mm-hmm. than ruthenium trichloride?
Yes or no, depending on the depends on the. Oops.
Very comprehensive answer.
Yeah, actually, yeah, very political answer at this stage because so I know something I don't fully understand yet, but I think it depends. That when I say yes or no, I think this depends on the what orbitals you have in this center here. So, for example, I think that the reason that I like the bismuth is that bismuth here is very covalent, and what they do is that they will not choose the, if you just count, you will have S orbitals. But if you put it in an ab initio calculation, you will immediately note that the P orbitals are just sitting well above the chemical potential, and what nearby is, in fact, it's a P orbitals. So you like to have a something finite angular momentum P orbitals, and once you have that P orbitals, then they will have some strong impact on these oxygens. So the, in principle, what you are asking, yes, I think that's the, in general, that's the case. If you, it's a proximity. So you can put it into the, some heavy atoms, which has strong spin-orbit coupling, then they will have some induced spin-orbit coupling. But the strength of it will depend on the, whether you have S orbitals, which are heavy, you know, heavy atoms give you S orbital or give you the P orbitals. If it is giving a P orbitals like a bismuth, it's a better position to deal with the bigger induced spin-orbit coupling.
Okay.
So referring back to your phase diagram where mm-hmm. the spin liquid is just this tiny, not quite a point, but mm-hmm. Just a little bigger than the point.
Yep.
How should we think about these results from Matsuda-san where
mm-hmm.
Seems to be evidence for this spin mm-hmm. liquid? Are we just immensely lucky, or what would be your comment to that?
Yeah, I think I should ask Matsuda-san here. So yes, we are having very tiny spin liquid here, especially if you are really thinking about Kitaev spin, not just the quantum spin liquid with other excitations. If you're really thinking about Kitaev spin liquid with the Majorana excitations, because you got a half quantized, not just quantized, then the difficulty of whether how you can stabilize is under a strong magnetic field, because his field is 7 Tesla. It's not small, by the way. So that is actually a difficult question. What we have recently found is that if you have a gamma interaction here, so if you are in the antiferrogamma with a ferromagnetic guttaev, it is possible that this guttaev interaction can be stabilized in the presence of antiferrogamma. Although the window is not exactly what he's seeing, but I think in principle, this window can be extended. In other words, a phase diagram, if you go around this ferro-guttaev to a positive gamma to a negative gamma, one can show that there is some SU2 point. Okay, so let's say that I'm starting from plus gamma and go along this line, and then this is a minus gamma, ferro-gamma. Then ferro-gamma and the ferro-guttaev, there's an SU2 point. So there's SU2 point where it's solvable. You can show that why the window of the guttaev interaction moves to something like this is because there is a magnetic order state which will give you a lot of the curvature of the phase diagram. So anyway, the conclusion that I want to say is that it is possible, in principle, that some other interaction, especially this gamma interactions, because gamma itself is completely frustrated as well, and there is a debate over a lot of people that this itself can be spin-Likert or magnetically ordered. Some people say it's a 12-side order. Some people say 6-side order. Some people say zigzag order. Some people say spin-Likert. So this itself is already a pretty complex, even single Hamiltonian. And if you add both of them, there is a tendency that this guttaev interaction will be extended slightly more than this itself, but not very much. So one has to be careful, but there is, in principle, there is a way to make them. I don't think how to get it into the above the 7 Tesla is still a question. So I think it's something that we're still working on it. Yeah, and other people working on it too.
So I have a question on your S1. Uh-huh. So the materials you presented that could be candidates. Now the issue is that all these, at least those that I know, they order.
Yes.
So we would be playing the same game as we are playing now, probably with the materials we have for the D5, right?
Yeah.
So again, we would have to do something to the materials to get them away from. So my question is, do you think there could be more hope in these systems?
Yes. Yeah. So I wish I had this phase diagram that Kiran had with. Mm-hmm. So this, let's say that this system is near the antiferro.
So this is a zigzag chain because we
did
calculations.
Right.
So
I know you are one of the co-authors in this paper.
It's a zigzag,
so both of this one has the zigzag order in the.
Yeah.
And the way that I'm thinking is the following. So what I'm thinking is that this system is here. Let's say zigzag orders, and probably near the antiferromagnetic guttaev. And this is a spin one, but you can also imagine what happens in the spin half. So in the spin half case, with under the field, what Kiran and Simon has shown is that if you have just plus minus J, and I think Kiran can add to my, if I'm wrong, that I remember that if you add along the, if you're starting from here, then what happens is that this zigzag will have a kind of intermediate as a function of field here. Then this one will have a guttaev spin-Likert, but there is this intermediate state which has a tendency to go truthing inside here. So it's a poking out of the guttaev zigzag. So when I'm moving along the zigzag, I will actually see the if I'm near the guttaev. If I'm far away, then I have no hope. But if you are very near the guttaev and the antiferro guttaev spin-Likert and the zigzag, as I'm starting from zigzag, moving along here, this gapless spin-Likert, that intermediate field that show up, will have a phase boundary which actually coming, sticking out of this phase. So you can see the gapless spin-Likert might appear in the intermediate field. So there is a hope if it is close by, right? If I'm not mistaken, that's your phase diagram. It's like a looking, sticking out of it. Close, yeah, but it's not like this is like just confined within here, and there's no hope that you are going to enter it. You look at your data carefully. I look at it because I anticipate a discussion. So I look at them very carefully. This gapless one's actually coming out of.
The hope is also that you can play with this gapless phase. So
yes.
the richness of the anti-ferromagnetic KITAEF case.
Yes.
Where you also have this.
Right.
Which
and
is not the KITAEF, but it's also.
Yes. So it may not be a KITAEF. But it'll be an intermediate gapless spin ligand, which in fact D5 cannot access.
Yeah.
So this is probably a one way to see this intermediate gapless spin ligand, which they said you want. I am not very sure about it, but you can see a collapse of this phases here. So.
Okay.
Maybe one very short question, actually. If you see that it's very difficult to get S1, wouldn't it be maybe easier to get KITAEF for spin 3 halves? T2 G3, the strong spin orbit coupling, it will be partially filled one hole in quartet, S3 half quartet. But it will S3 half quartet with one hole. Wouldn't it be maybe easier than to struggle with spin 1?
So the difficulty that I have with
T2 G3.
Yes, I know
that.
So that's exactly T2G3 is exactly where that goes. This chromium, that guy here.
Yeah.
This is in fact T2G3. It's a D3, and we've been working for 2 months to collect the perturbation terms. It's in. You have like over a 10 million intermediate state. So. I was able to write down the SQL 1, SQL 3 half is actually a lot of them because you have completely filled p orbitals, and then T2G you can have three different orbitals, and then you go through three whole process. So there's a single hole, two holes, and so on. So what we have done, so at least Peter has looked at this one, writing a code that can read the Hamiltonian, and then the machine actually produced the perturbation terms. We can plot it as a function of some parameters. They do have finite KITAEF, but so this is actually very, very interesting material. I think that those who knows a little bit about this is that single layer has a ferromagnet.
But maybe here.
So there is an anisotropy here.
You hit chromium 3 plus without strong spin orbit coupling. You have chromium 3 plus without strong spin orbit coupling, and you played with spin orbit coupling on iodine.
Yes.
But it could be that maybe one could use T2G3 for 5D. So that you would get strong spin orbit coupling on transition metal itself.
Yes.
Which would be more similar maybe just to iridate.
Yes, yes.
But so, with three electrons on J3 half quartet.
Yes, correct.
That's what I mean.
Yes, yes, yes.
And maybe
yes.
Then not using spin orbit on ligand, but spin orbit on transition metal.
Yes, yes. So in principle,
One could think of that.
Yes. There, you instead of 3D here, one can use 5D with a 3.
Yeah, rhenium, whatever. Rhenium, G2G3,
yes.
Whatever.
The reason that we got interested in this one is because it's one was able to make a single layer, and single layer has a ferromagnetic up to the 45 Kelvin, which is, and we know that the Ising anisotropy is tiny here. There is not much of trigonal distortion here. So. The compound, people have looked at it like, okay, maybe an XXZ model, maybe it's a strong Ising anisotropy, but I don't think that's right. So it has some KITAEF anisotropic bond-dependent interactions here.
No, that's definitely true, actually. Yes. This material, Igor Mazin did rather detailed calculations also. And there is indeed not single-site anisotropy, no Ising single-site,
but a lot of
anisotropic inter-site terms. That's known.
Correct. Yes.
For this one, no.
Yeah.
What we recently did, actually, vanadium iodine 3, maybe you don't know this one. And this one seems to be indeed Ising single site.
Mm-hmm.
But otherwise, it's very similar. Also ferro.
Yes, yes.
Isolated single layer yet, but in principle, it should be the same. Vanadium iodine 3, D2.
Yes.
But this seems to be indeed single site Ising.
Yes, but not this one. Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. Agree.
Okay. With this, I think we can come to the end of this afternoon session. Let's thank Young and all the other speakers again.